Diana Johnstone is an American journalist based in Paris.
She has frequently contributed to Z Magazine and its online edition ZNet. She is an expert on the Balkans and her Fool's Crusade, Yugoslavia, NATO, and Western Delusions. It's considered one of the best texts on the U.S.-NATO war to destroy Yugoslavia. She's also the author of The Politics of the Euro Missiles, Europe's Role in America's World. If they're not available at your local bookstore, you can get them online. Welcome to Takes on the World, Diana.
Hello. Glad to speak with you again.
Yes, the last time was in your apartment in Paris, which I wouldn't mind being at the moment.
Oh, yes, you'd enjoy it. It's very nice.
We're having an unusual summer where it's raining. In an article you wrote following the vote in France, you described the French rejection of the European Constitution as essentially a vote against dogmatic free market policies. What were some of these policies and how have they been impacted on France?
Well, the main point is simply that everything, according to this Constitution, has to pass the test of being compatible with an unrestrained free market. So that is a threat to public services in particular, which, for instance, I give an example is the post service. France has been shutting down post offices in villages, which helps to kill off little villages because there's no postal service there, which is also used as a bank and is very much of a convenience for the older population that lives in villages. And this is because they're not so profitable. And so this is an example. Also, you cut down train lines that don't have as many passengers, even if they're absolutely essential to the population. So putting profit at the top is very threatening to public services, which serve the public precisely by using the profits from the more profitable branches of their activity to finance the less profitable for the benefit of citizens. And a lot of this kind of policy is dictated by the rules that come out of Brussels, demanding competition, free competition for just about everything. And this is, I think, the main thing that was objected to here.
It's interesting that the European leaders who were so confident and so desirous of this vote being a yes vote, like Joaquin Almunia from Portugal said, problem was that public opinion had not received a clear explanation of why the reforms are necessary. And why you can expect that in a normal period of time would be positive results, that the people weren't, if they knew about it, they would have voted differently.
Well, you know, that is just exactly typical of the way the whole political media ruling class has reacted, that the task of politicians is to convince people that they should do what they've been told to do. And so that's why Jacques Chirac is being very much criticized, because it can't be that the people made a knowledgeable choice. It has to be that they weren't properly convinced. You see, this is like from Reagan being the communicator. Politicians are no longer representatives of the people. They are communicators to tell the people what they have to buy. Now, the fact is that the French public was extraordinarily well-informed about this constitution, quite amazingly so. It's rather unprecedented for all. They weren't that aware of the Maastricht Treaty in 1992. But people were actually reading this ghastly document, which shows great civic self-sacrifice, if you take a look at it, and reading books about it and holding meetings and discussions about it. So, in fact, in the end, the people who voted no knew the text better than the people who were trying to sell it. It was rather comic in that way.
One of the things that has been put forth here in American media, particularly by the pundit Tom Friedman, I think you may have read his column, in which he talks about the concern of the Polish plumbers, but what he says is really, obviously someone who hasn't ever soiled his hands working, he says it's interesting because French voters are trying to preserve a 35-hour work week in a world where Indian engineers are ready to work a 35-hour day. Good luck. I don't think the Indian engineers would say where they're ready to work a 35-hour day or have Tom Friedman speak for them. But what do you think of that reaction and his criticism of the old Europe and what they, in which they're trying to save benefits for blue-collar workers that were actually implemented, I believe, as a counter to what was provided for workers in East Europe before the collapse of the socialist bloc?
Well, that's a little bit complicated. Let me
about
this Polish plumbers business, which is a typical media nothing. I mean, I have followed discussions, been to meetings, etc. I never heard anybody talk about Polish plumbers. That's something that was invented for the media, I think, because of its alliteration, two-piece, Polish plumbers, you know, that becomes a sort of slogan. In fact, there was this Dutch commissioner who himself mentioned that he would bring Polish electricians to his country house in northern France because he couldn't find any there, which was, of course, a very rude remark to make about the French electricians, and that caused a great deal of humorous reaction. But that was not a serious issue at all. And in fact, nobody minds Polish plumbers coming to work in France at the same, demanding the same fees and the same rights as French plumbers. They'd be quite welcome. The problem was that this particular commissioner was behind a directive that would enable companies to hire, say, a Polish plumber, bring him to France, have him work in France, and pay him Polish wages, which clearly would undercut the minimum wage which exists in France and is available to everybody who comes here and works legally. So this whole Polish plumbers thing is just absurd and untrue. Now, as far as the work week was cut in France, not because people are unwilling to work, but in fact because greater productivity has brought about automation. So the idea behind that shortening the work week was to provide, to spread the work around to give to combat employment. This has not worked terribly well, but that was the idea. It has nothing to do with people being lazy. In fact, I think people here work quite as hard and want to work and enjoy their work quite as much as anyone else. And perhaps they enjoy their work more because they manage to eat well, have health coverage, and have vacations.
And don't get called off to foreign wars.
Well, that's another,
anymore, at least. How about the comparison? It's something that was seemed to be quite obvious, was that as long as the East European Socialist Bloc provided excellent working benefits and vacations for their workers there, if not the highest wages, at least guaranteed work, housing, and so on, subsidized housing, that the West had to maintain a certain level of benefits. And once the bloc collapsed, we saw the collapse, the chipping away, as it will, of the benefits that workers had gained in Western Europe.
Well, that's clearly so. And, of course, it's the most striking example has been East Germany, where the East Germans were completely seduced, you might say, by all of the goodies in the department stores in West Germany, just looking forward to buying them all, but then they ended up with no jobs, and they're free to go there and go and look in the stores, but they don't have the money to buy anything or the jobs. And that has been, in fact, that type of unification of Germany really amounted to West Germany buying out East Germany, shutting down their factories and their production, replacing their journalists. I remember that absolutely happening. And it was a takeover that has cost West Germany a lot and ruined the life, the standard of living of a whole lot of East Germans. The fact is, nevertheless, a lot of them welcome it because it's true that the freedom, whatever it brings, does please a lot of people. That's true. But the economic consequences have been very bad. Enlarging the European Union has some of the same characteristics, though it's a bit different because, the German case is a little bit special because of the fact that it's a single language, a single people.
Yeah, I wanted to actually get to the European Union in a moment, but one of the things we saw is that in Germany, that the vote to approve the European Constitution, EU Constitution, was not taken by the people, but the Bundestag. And that you suggest in your article that if the people themselves had voted for it, there might have been a different outcome. And it's the same if the French Parliament had voted for it, there might have been a different outcome.
Well, it's absolutely unquestionable that if the French Parliament had voted for it, it would have been overwhelmingly approved, since an overwhelming majority of the French parliamentarians were in favor of it. So there's every reason to think that the difference between the votes doesn't have so much to do with the populations of the country as with the method that's chosen to approve this document. That if a parliament has the vote, they vote for it. Now, the exception was Spain. Spain had a referendum very early. By all accounts, it was a very small turnout, and even with the turnout, very few people had read the document. There, the political class sold it to the Spanish as a vote for Europe. And since Spain came rather late to Europe and associates Europe with greater prosperity and the end of Franco-fascism, etc., it was very easy to get a big yes vote if you just say what you're voting for is Europe without looking at the fine print. In France, however, they did look at the fine print, and the same thing would probably have happened in Germany. Now, it's interesting because the next referendum is supposed to be in Luxembourg. Now, Luxembourg is considered, well, goodness, this little country, it profits, it's the banking center of the European Union, it's totally pro-Europe, and there's indication that even Luxembourg, with a referendum, may vote against it. So, you see, I think that's why so many countries like Sweden, et cetera, are not giving in to the request to have a referendum, because it's so dangerous to put this question to the population.
Now, one of the things you mentioned before, and this is quite interesting and probably the effect here has not been appreciated as much, is the addition of all the countries that used to be in what we call the East Bloc that were considered to be satellites of the Soviet Union are now more or less satellites of the United States, at least if the populace is not, the government seemed to be. What effect has that had on the French, do you believe?
Oh, I think that's had a very negative effect. You know, in the recent commemorations of the end of World War II in Europe, and Bush went to the Baltic states, and some of the Baltic states wouldn't even celebrate that, because the fact is, and this is suddenly coming to people's consciousness, that this is not just one big Europe that has a single history. The Baltic states were very largely on the side of the Nazis, and so they have a totally different view of things. And, for instance, there are demands from the Baltic states to outlaw communist parties, to outlaw symbols of communism. Now, in France, this makes an extremely negative impression, and that's also a reason not to want to bring in Turkey, although that wasn't such an issue here. It was more of an issue in the Netherlands, not because Turkey would have the problem with the Baltic states, but simply because the fact is Turkey has a different history from most of Europe, and that means that the political culture has a different frame of reference. And it's hard enough, I worked in the European Parliament for 7 years, and it's hard enough to get Germans and Italians to necessarily understand each other correctly. And constantly enlarging is making the thing absolutely unmanageable, and that's a big reason for the rejection. It's simply that the original project, you see, they have been trying to sell the European Union as this big United States of Europe that can be a counterpower to the United States. That stopped being the case when they enlarged so much. It's just not manageable anymore.
Well, you have so many different cultures and languages that the notion that's been advanced that sooner or later this could become like the United States and function like that if we just wait long enough seems to be really remote.
Well, it's so remote that I think it would take, well, maybe 500 years, but you know, that's really, even the most far-sighted of us aren't ready to gamble on that. This has been terribly The differences between populations and nations has been very, very much underestimated by a class of people that I saw a lot in Brussels, who are well-educated people, who speak several languages, who feel perfectly comfortable in every country. This is a surface population that does not at all represent or correspond to the majority of the population of Europe.
Well, particularly in the Netherlands, is the case of immigration. And even in France, there was a coming together, not on paper or in meetings, but of the left and the right, because the right wing in Europe has been very much anti-Muslim, anti-immigration, and evidently that was more of an issue in the Netherlands. Perhaps you comment on that.
Well, yes, it does seem to be much more of an issue in the Netherlands. And there have been some incidents, a couple of assassinations of people who were very provocatively anti-Muslim, which has raised the temperature there. And also one must remember that the Netherlands is the most densely populated country in Europe. And so the presence of a very large population with visibly different customs can be harder to digest than it is in some other countries. I think that's just a sociological fact. And you see, this is a problem for the left, too, because the left, in some sense, is demanding contradictory things. The left tends to demand full employment for everybody and open borders for everybody. And the two things are obviously not compatible. I mean, you simply cannot provide jobs for everybody and let in every possible foreigner. This is an ideal that is not realistic, and the far left tends to make these two demands. And of course, this is one reason that, you know, the no is not a clear program in itself. It's a rejection of the Constitution, but it opens the way to all kinds of campaigns now for various policies, sometimes contradictory.
Is there a possibility that a constitution would ever be worked out, or is a constitution really necessary to carry on the economic business of the EU, which is basically what it came together for?
One problem is that this so-called constitution was not just a constitution. A constitution should be a fairly short document setting out the rules of operation of institutions. And the big problem of this constitution is that it went way beyond that to define every conceivable policy, economic and foreign, everything. And this is absurd in a constitution. What could be possible is to go back to the drawing board and come up with a short document that simplifies the rules of operation. But the fact is that the rules of operation of the European Union, as they are and as they were envisioned in this constitution, are extremely complex and very hard to follow and very much more devious and non-transparent than those policies and institutions of the various democratic member states. And I think that while these rules should be improved, I think that it's a big mistake to try to give the European Union authority over every possible field, because I think that one should go slowly and go and take subject by subject. For instance, the environment is a subject where harmonization is really very important. Fisheries is a subject where it's absolutely important to agree on who fishes what, because otherwise there won't be any fish left. There are certain things like that that are really urgent, but there are other things that there should be more letting the member states work out their own policies in a lot of areas that the European Union wants to manage, and this only causes hostility, I think.
Well, one other something else that's came up, and I haven't heard much of it since, is whether the European Union would have its own military. We have this organization called NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which has a major player in the United States. And it has added some of the European countries as well. Where does NATO fit into all this?
Well, that was a major objection to this constitution, because Article 41 stipulates that the military policy of the Union has to be compatible with the membership in NATO of the member states who belong to it, which is practically all of them. And so, in fact, it was just absurd then to say that you're going to have Europe set up as a counterweight in the foreign and military field to the United States, when at the same time you tie it to NATO, which is, as everybody knows, is the United States' instrument for dominating Europe's foreign and military policy. So this is just one of the most extreme contradictions in this text, between the text and what people were saying it could do.
One of the criticisms that has been brought up against the French, and I want to go back to some of the American attitudes, is quite contradictory. It says, and you wrote about that, many Americans who feel very insecure when it comes to France, I think it's kind of an inferiority complex versus French culture and American culture, that there's a nostalgia for empire on the part of the French people, where it would seem that if anyone had it, it would be the leadership of the French people, the so-called leadership, the media, political officials, and so on. How do you respond to this idea of nostalgia for empire on the part of the French people?
Well, I think it's amazing how many people who know nothing about France seem to set themselves up as authorities about it and go around repeating this thing that there's nostalgia for empire. I mean, I've been living here for 30 years, and I've never noticed this. It just doesn't exist. See, France, under de Gaulle, decided that to be a modern, important modern country, colonies were out of, and they would leave them. There is no nostalgia for empire whatsoever in the French population. That is just absolutely absurd. I don't know where people get this, except that it's one of these myths that somebody says it, and then it's repeated and repeated and repeated, and it goes around from pundit to pundit, and without anything, isn't based on anything at all.
It's interesting, but it makes people comfortable, but they give excuses for failing to understand what's going
on.
Well,
I think in the United States, since the United States is a big imperial power in itself, there are a lot of people who think, we're a big imperial power, ha, 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 the French must be jealous of us. It's sort of a way of trying to find some way that the United States is superior to France. We're an empire, and they used to be, but they aren't anymore. I mean, this is like children on a playground.
I agree, but Americans, when they go to France, they usually come back, and they feel very overcome because most of them don't speak any of the language, and they feel that the French are, they love to go to Paris. It's obviously the most visited tourist spot in the world, but they say the French are not friendly or this or that, which is, they may like Paris, but they come away with some negative images of the French, which has not been my experience having been over there and lived there myself. What is the future of the European economy, and even in terms of the euro keeping its value against the dollar? See any changes happening in that?
Well, let's take the middle of the road of the no, which would be represented, say, by Jean-Pierre Chevènement, who was not very prominent in this campaign, but represents, I think, the middle of the road, as sort of the left Republicans who were part of the no campaign. I think the main position there, which is shared by some of the socialists for the no, is that there has to be an end to this monetarist dictatorship of the euro, that it has been strangling European economic growth. And one way or another, this has to be changed so that there can be at least a minimal type of Keynesian policy of borrowing in order to stimulate the economy, because that was outlawed with the Maastricht Treaty in 1992. So I do think that there's going to be some change in economic policies, because this monetarist policy is strangling the German economy most of all, and also other economies in the EU. So I do think there will be changes in economic policy. I don't know exactly how that will work out. One of the reasons for this no also was not just the Constitution, but the fact that 1 year ago, the British vetoed the Belgian candidate that was the candidate of France and Germany and Belgium and so on, for commissioner, and put in Juan Manuel Barroso, who is absolutely a pawn of the United States. He was educated in the United States. He spent his youth as an anti-communist Maoist militant in Portugal against the communist left and the radical military that ran the revolution. And Barroso appointed a commission that is totally, totally free market fanatics. And this is another thing that has turned the French off on the European Union. That's something that hasn't been reported on very much, but it's a big factor.
What is the future of French politics in Chirac after this defeat? Is there a chance for the left to move up?
Actually, the initial effect of this looks to me a bit negative, because waiting in the wings on the right is Sarkozy, who would be a good bit worse than Chirac. And it's true, Chirac has been very much politically defeated by this vote. And on the left, the Socialist Party is totally split by this vote. So it's going to take some doing to get together a left alternative, because the leadership of the Socialist Party, which called for a yes vote, has been very vengeful against those who were for the no, rather than seeking reconciliation, has been pushing them aside. And that's not a very good sign for recomposition of the left.
And speaking of the left, what is the state of the opposition to the war in Iraq in France today?
Well, you see, this is unfortunate. It's a little bit like the United States. It's the movement that was so big before the war. Afterwards, it has just it's gone. There's no movement. But on the other hand, everybody's against it. Everybody's against the U.S. war in Iraq, but they don't do anything about it.
Are there any? Is this the failure of political organizations, or just a kind of a failure of a fear of inadequacy?
I don't think it's either one. I mean, well, it's more the first than the second. Yeah, the failure of organizations. That's true, but this fits in more to. It's almost a result of the unanimity.
You mean against it?
Against it. I mean, you know, the government's against it, everybody's against it, so why have a movement? Everybody's against it, you see.
We have a problem here because we have many activists who are against the war, but we have no movement, per se, and we can't even get a single congressperson to sign an impeachment resolution against the resident Bush, even though his poll numbers are down and the violations of his oath of office are manifest, as this Downing Street memo, which I talked about earlier before I called you, has raised very little temperature here in the United States. And when Blair and Bush had a press conference yesterday, nobody asked them about it. We have a very polite media. Speaking just to one last issue, speaking of the French media, there has been a great deal of publicity here in this country, more publicity about this issue than about the Downing Street memo, about so-called anti-Semitism in France. And maybe perhaps you could comment on that in the recent case of Le Monde being found guilty of publishing something that was considered to be anti-Semitic, was in fact a criticism of Israel. We just have about
there are a certain number of organizations that just constantly harass people. It's funny because Edgar Morin, that was the latest one that was condemned, is a very sort of wishy-washy commentator who says very middle-of-the-road things about everything, and actually nobody's paid much attention to that. There's a kind of intimidation that's going on. There's a recent book by someone named Nicolas Reynaldvey. That's a tough name to get across the telephone. Reynaldweill. He's the twin brother of one of these small number of people who are constantly writing that France is anti-Semitic and the media is anti-Semitic and everything's anti-Semitic. This is clearly an intimidation, a double intimidation. One thing is to shut up any criticism of Israel, and the other thing is to try to scare France's large Jewish population into going to Israel. because Israel needs population. And the twin brother, there are two Renan Veil, and the twin brother of the one who is complaining about anti-Semitic has written a book called La Haine Imaginaire, The Imaginary Hatred, pointing out very clearly that all these accusations of anti-Jewish stuff are just made up, just aren't true.
Diane, at that point, we're actually running out of time. I want to thank you very much for being our guest today in Takes on the World. And this is an interesting conversation, which I'd love to continue another time, and maybe we'll do that. So
okay,
thanks for being my
so.
Guest today.
You're very welcome.
Enjoy the Paris summer. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.